Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From New Sounds and the studios of WNYC in New York, this is the Soundcheck Podcast, our series of live in-studio performances, streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. I'm John Schaefer. The English singer and songwriter and guitarist Frank Turner has written political songs, personal songs, even political songs about being a better person, as in his tune called Make America Great Again. But his latest album is a remarkable and extraordinary mix of music, storytelling, and history. It's called No Man's Land, and apart from Frank himself, no men inhabit this musical landscape. Frank is here to play some of those songs for us. This one is called Ginny Bingham's Ghost.
If you're heading down to Camden Town, be sure to raise a toast to the patron saint of the waifs and strays, to Ginny Bingham's ghost. Well, when she was a fresh-faced lass from Kentish Town, she came. Her people, they were peddlers. Ginny Bingham was her name. And with her husband, Gypsy George, at Camden Coach House, they did keep till they hung him by his neck from Tyburn Tree for stealing sheep. It broke her heart to lose her love when she was just a child. So a man named Darby took the hand of Ginny, meek and mild. He was a drinker, not a thinker. Daily brought his wife to tears until one Camden winter morning, Darby simply disappeared. If you're heading down to Camden Town, be sure to raise a toast to the patron saint of the waits and strays, Ginny Bingham's ghost. Under reputation on those bitter Camden streets, if you'd tarry with the Bingham girl, you'd hold your manhood cheap. Even so, the miser pitcher was the third man on her lips. But one night they checked her oven and found him burned up to a crisp. They tried her for his murder, thought they'd finally cooked her goose. But even when the fourth man died, Ginny somehow slipped the noose. He was a fugitive from justice, for love she took him in. But he beat her once too often, and the poison did him in. If you're heading down to Camden Town, be sure to raise a toast to the patron saint of the waifs and strays, Ginny Bingham's ghost. The locals didn't like her, falsehoods followed her around. They called her wicked woman, sorceress of some renown. They swore upon the gravestones of her husband she'd grown rich. The rival and the righteous, they knew she was a witch. But the reason she was hated was a simple one indeed. She had kindness for the careless, took in those in need. The guilty and the gamblers, the harlots and the whores, all knew that Ginny offered sanctuary at her bar. No judgment for the judge, and you can never fall too far. On the day she died, they swore they saw the devil by her side. A mob broke down her door, and from her chair her body pried. The tavern is still standing, it's now called the Underworld, and it still offers sanctuary for all broken boys and girls. So let's head on down to Camden Town, and folks, let's raise a toast to the patron saint of the waifs and strays, Ginny Bingham's ghost.
There it is.
That is Frank Turner with Ginny Bingham's ghost. The Underworld is a club you've played at the Underworld.
Many times. Yeah. In fact, my old hardcore band that I used to be in, Million Dead, hold the attendance record for the Underworld. Our last ever show there, John, who runs the place, let us essentially sneak everybody in through the back door because we were breaking up the following day. It was a farewell show, and he just sort of said, whatever.
That was your last waltz.
It was, pretty much, yes. I mean, not perhaps of quite such cultural impact, shall we say. And Scorsese didn't show. But it was our swan song. Yes, definitely.
There's a pretty well-known pub on that corner in Camden
Town.
There is,
yes.
The World's End.
The World's End, which is built... The World's End and the Underworld are all kind of one building, and it is built on the site of a coaching house that was there from the 1600s that was run by a woman called Ginny Bingham, who was initially, earlier in her life, a popular member of the community. She went through a number of husbands. whether or not she killed all or indeed any of them is a matter of debate. But by the end of her life, you know, she was a woman running an independent business in the 1600s, which is a rare thing.
Yep.
And she was accused of witchcraft by the locals and generally seen as this kind of slightly monstrous local figure. And around the pub, they have signs up kind of telling her story, and I'd read them many a time whilst waiting for a friend before a gig at the Underworld or whatever. And I wanted to write a song about Camden because I love Camden, but you know, Suggs has covered the direct route of that pretty comprehensively, as has, you know, Pete Doherty and people like that. So it was a way of trying to write about Camden from a slightly more esoteric angle.
It certainly is. Was this early in the songwriting process for this record?
It was one of the first, and I think one of the things that that brings to mind is that regardless of what the albums ended up being in conception in the first place, the initial idea that I had was essentially, I write in an autobiographical style, usually. That's my kind of main thing that I do, in a confessional style, let's say. And I wanted to experiment with writing from other people's point of view or telling other people's stories, and also to indulge my passion for history.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing history songs, and the aim was to tell good stories that I felt people wouldn't know and that I felt that we could all do with knowing a little better collectively. And it was only after I'd written about five songs that it occurred to me that every song I'd written to date was about a female protagonist. And there is an implicit politics in this.
Yeah.
And it struck me as an interesting creative angle to pursue. I mean, I hesitate to use the word concept because I'm not quite sure it's a concept album.
Right.
It's a themed record.
Sure. Are you familiar with the South London band Sons of Kemet and their album Your Queen is a Reptile?
You know, I know the name of the band, but I can't say I'm familiar with that record.
Terrific record that they put out in which every song is a kind of instrumental, largely, portrait of a different woman, black women through history, from the Americas, from England,
amazing,
wherever.
Yeah.
And as with your record, they chose women who were not, some of whom were very well known, like Harriet Tubman, here in the States, but also women who were very little known, and Shabaka Hutchings, the sax player who leads the band, chose his own grandmother for one song.
Oh, that's amazing. Well,
album.
I closed out the record with a song about my own mother. It feels like we were on treading similar paths with this.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, like I shied away from writing songs about, let's say, Emmeline Pankhurst or Rosa Parks, people like that. Not because they're not important historical figures. Of course they are, but these are names that ring out already that we know, and I'm not sure that the didactic angle is less kind of emphasized there. You know, I wanted to tell stories that most people, and I should emphasize, including myself, didn't know prior to this album being a thing.
Yeah. I knew of, you call her Princess Cassiana. I knew her as just Princess Cassia.
Yeah, Cassia, Cassiani.
Cassiani,
it's sort of interchangeable. There's some debate. I think that Cassiani is the more religious formulation of her name.
Okay. So either way, Byzantine princess. I know her name simply because she was a composer.
She was. She's one of the only known female composers from that period of history. Fact about her which blew my mind and took me into writing about her: she is one of only two women whose signatures we have from the pre-industrial era.
Really?
Yeah, the other one's Joan of Arc, who signed her own confession.
Wow.
And she signed some of her hymn books. Two women out of 50% of the human race for almost the entirety of our history. It's insane.
Yeah. But what I didn't know is that, as your song about her explains, that she had turned down the
emperor. She was a part of they used to have bride shows for the emperor to pick his bride, which is quite a thing. And legend has it that
it's the first reality TV show.
Kind of, yeah. And the Emperor Theophilus was passing down the line and took a fancy to Cassiani and said so. And she quipped back at him, a biblical quip, which is quite hard to translate, but essentially it was kind of clever and funny and a put down. And not only this, but one of the sources says that he didn't really get it and had to have the joke explained, which, as you can imagine, didn't go over enormously well with the supreme ruler of the empire.
Right.
So she has all these aphorisms that survive, books and books of them. Mm. They're these sort of one-liner kind of notes of wisdom, and you know, they're sort of, "I hate stupid people" is one of the more forthright ones. but one, they're all, "I hate this, I hate that." But one of them is, I hate silence when it is time to speak." which I think is a wonderful thing, and I managed to get that into the lyrics to the song.
Well, you said that there's a political implication to this, and to make it explicit, it is that history has been written largely by men.
Yeah, totally,
and so
absolutely.
A lot of these stories are just kind of
They're by the wayside. I mean, I think it might be too much of a stretch to say it quite this simply, but I guess the idea is that if some of these protagonists had been men, we would be familiar with their stories already. More broadly as well, I think, you know, the point for me, because I'm whilst in no way a professional historian, I'm a massive history obsessive, should we say. Mm-hmm. And the point about historiography as a concept is that it matters who writes down the history.
Right.
And that there are other ways of looking at what happened in our past, and that you have to interrogate your sources to figure out who's telling you what you know. And indeed, I did my best to do a little bit of that whilst writing this record, although it is important to stress that this is a raconteur album. It's a storytelling
yeah.
record, you know.
Yeah.
There are moments of creative license on my part because I'm trying to tell a good yarn, and that is my driving aim with these. But, you know, it's wonderful to me that now at my shows or on social media or whatever, there are now people discussing Ginny Bingham or Mata Hari or Princess Cassiani or whoever, you know, who wouldn't have been known these names, and that's a small achievement.
Rosetta Tharpe,
yes.
the subject of the song Sister Rosetta,
yes.
is somewhat known.
She
should be.
Yeah, it should be.
All we hear church people say, they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day.
I feel like my writing about her has coincided with a general kind of upsurge in interest mm-hmm. in her. In fact, there is a small irony in the song for me, in that I wrote the song about 4 years ago, and the conclusionary line of the song was Rosetta for the Hall of Fame, because at the time she was not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I had this idea that I was going to like run
like
a petition.
Protest, yeah.
Yeah, and I was going to like nail it to the gates of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame like Martin Luther. In between writing the song and actually getting around to recording it and releasing it, she has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Fantastic news, but I did have to change a lyric to make that work. But yes, I mean, she's a fascinating character. You know, I came across her because Johnny Cash and Elvis both cited her as one of their favorite singers.
Hmm.
And well, if you're interested in those people, that's a significant thing.
There are some who claim that, you know, the first rock and roll record wasn't Rocket 88 or even the Jump Blues of Louis Jordan, but a song that you reference.
Yeah,
in,
Rock Me. I mean, certainly from what I can discover, that is the first kind of public use of the word rock to refer to music of any kind. I mean, obviously, the rock and roll was an idiom that evolved in African-American culture, but like the first record that uses the word rock in its title is almost certainly Rock Me by Sister Rosetta Tharpe. I think one of the things I found interesting, because we made a podcast for the album and I was able
right.
to interview people who actually know what they're talking about. And I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and one of their archivists there was telling me about the Pentecostal religion, which was her upbringing. And again, this might be overly simplistic or mechanistic, but there's a line to be drawn between the whole tradition of speaking in tongues and that kind of very, very visceral, joyous release of energy and emotion in a slightly non-verbal way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a link between that and the way that Sister Rosetta played the guitar that you can then trace through to the solos of Keith Richards. You know, it's there's something extremely primal about that form of communication, and the best soloists speak with their guitars.
And funnily enough, Sister Rosetta Tharpe may have had a bigger influence in Britain than here because of
yeah.
the famous journey that she made in the early
1964. 60s. Yeah. Well, this is a fascinating piece of history for me because there's a famous thing in Britain. In the 1960s, there was a thing called the Beeching Report, where they shut down about a third of the railway network because it wasn't making money, it was losing money. The railways were nationalised in the 1940s, and then there used to be a lot more kind of small railway lines that connected small villages and stuff, and they shut down about a third of it. In 1964, Sister Rosetta Tharpe came to England, brought over by the kind of the nerdy folk and blues enthusiasts who brought lots of people like Muddy Waters over in that
yeah.
period of time. And she did a tour of a recently abandoned train platforms around the UK. I mean, it's the weirdest thing.
Wow.
And one of them was filmed, and you can find it on YouTube, but she did quite a few. Legend has it, and nobody knows for sure, but legend has it that people like Clapton and Beck and Richards caught some of these shows, and or at the very least became aware of her at
right.
this period of time,
right.
and that she influenced their guitar playing.
She is one of the architects of the sound of rock and roll.
Yeah, and who was largely written out of history after 1956. There are other reasons for that. I mean, she was so iconoclastic. She was very religious, you know, and she not only was she an African-American woman, but by the kind of like the 50s, she was a middle-aged African-American woman singing religious songs. I mean, it just, if to the extent that rock and roll was an explosion of an adolescent market, I mean, she's not your prime figure to go to for that from a marketing point of view.
All right, well, let's do a little posthumous marketing of Sister Rosetta.
Yes.
Frank Turner is here. The album is called it looks like No Man's Land, but I'm going to say No Man's Land.
I like that. I appreciate that.
And this song is called Sister Rosetta.
It is. And I should say just before I play it that I'm obviously, you know, the thing as a white man playing this kind of music, I'm aware of the irony in that. But this is the point to me, is that it's behoven to people like me to pay respect to the people who laid down the blueprints that we follow. So this is my thank you to Sister Rosetta. And this song's called Sister Rosetta.
Sister Rosetta, godmother of rock and roll, the original sister of soul. All our music was in her. She brought rhythm from the darkness into the light. She brought the good word to the night to save all our sinners. Rosetta rolled her eyes when she played. She knew that strange things happen every day, and that the white boy hype eventually fade, but the way that she played would remain. New York City, it was 1938. The radio couldn't wait for Rosetta to rock it. Instant sensation, and little Elvis, Chuck and Johnny at home heard her on the gramophone, and they wouldn't forget it. Rosetta rolled her eyes when she played. She knew that strange things happen every day, and that the white boy hype would eventually fade, but the way that she played would remain. Rosetta's in the Hall of Fame. Don't let her be forgotten in a church in Arkansas. Remember her teaching the Cotton Club the glory of the Lord. Don't let her be forgotten, Rosetta deserves more. Remember her teaching a nation on a train platform in England in 1964. Rosetta, she saw the bright lights fade away. She saw at the last of her days in the suburbs of Philly, down by the river. She still heard music in the air, up above her head and everywhere, on a train bound for glory. Rosetta rolled her eyes when she played. She knew that strange things happen every day, and that the white boy hype would eventually fade, but the way that she played would remain. Rosetta rolled her eyes when she played. She knew that strange things happen every day, and that the white boy hype would eventually fade, but the way that she played.
Once again, Frank Turner live here in our studio with his song called Sister Rosetta, a celebration of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, amazing guitarist. She wrote songs like This Train and
Strange Things Happen Every Day,
the song you reference in the chorus of the song. So you mentioned before playing it, you know, being a white guy celebrating this. Has this album been a case of no good deed going unpunished? Have you taken flack for...
Yeah.
Really?
A degree, yeah. And I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, first of all, you know, I've been doing this for long enough now. This is my eighth record. I'm kind of used to the way that the internet functions, which is an outrage machine. But I have to be very careful to make a distinction between two separate phenomena. To the extent that there are people who are just looking for something to be annoyed about, I'm not sure how much of my time and energy I need to invest in paying attention to that. There are good faith discussions to be had. There are questions to be raised, and I'm absolutely sure that there are moments where I could have, or at least I could look again at the way that I've phrased stuff and all that kind of thing, and I want to be receptive and open to that. I mean, in writing the record, my then partner, now wife, I'm very pleased to say, you know,
That's a recent thing.
It is. I'm 2 months into being married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's awesome. I can recommend it highly. but, you know, she is a creative person. She's a writer herself and all the rest of it. And I sat down with her with a lot of the lyrics and just sort of said, which bits of this are clunky dude talk. Do you know what I mean? And not many, but there were a couple of lines where she was like, yeah, don't know about that, you know. And I want to be receptive. I mean, you know, some people have sort of questioned the project in and of itself, and my response to that is just simply that, like, I have an audience. This seems to annoy some people, but it's true. I have an audience, and I'm going to make another record. And I can make another record about being sad about my love life, although, I mean, I can't right now. But, you know, I can talk about other things. I could make a record about men from history, but that just seems like a not particularly useful contribution to the debate. And, you know, we do a lot of work with a group based here in New York called the Ally Coalition. And that's a great word to me, is the word ally. You know, I've been hesitant to use the word feminism too boldly about this record because I don't want to be seen to be trying to jump in front of a parade that I should be contributing to but not trying to lead, right. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I hope the record is implicitly feminist, but I don't want to sit here trying to get a pat on the head, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the main thing is just, you know, every night I see people in my audience and I get emails and stuff, and, you know, people say, I've got two young daughters, or even I've got a young son who never thought about this stuff before and now he's interested in how we've talked about history and all the rest of it. Again, I don't want this record to be overwhelmingly like didactic, you know, and I didn't set out to teach the world. I'm writing songs and telling stories. That's what I do. But, well, to the extent that there's a didactic angle, I'll stand by it.
Well, some of the songs do actually tell. I mean, you know, you're naming names and dates in some of the songs, and that's a part of the folk tradition. You know,
well, exactly.
It's really an extension.
You know, I want the storytelling song. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking about, you know, traditional folk songs or Dylan songs, or in particular, actually, Springsteen, you know, often writes character songs.
Right.
But yeah, you know, the old history songs about kind of like freight trains and ships that sunk and all that kind of thing.
All those murder ballads, sadly, many of them were ripped from the headlines of the day.
Exactly. And in fact, Nick Cave's Murder Ballads album was kind of something of a guiding light in this record for me, sort of structurally, should we say, because it's a themed record rather than a concept record.
Right.
And also, I might add, one
although
of my
yours has
albums.
A lot less salty language.
It does. It does. I did. There was a moment when I was writing the record where I suddenly went, a lot of these songs are about death. And my wife pointed out to me that I'm writing about people who have died because they're historical figures. So it's not actually that unusual that it might mention the end of their life, given that they are all dead, apart from my mom.
Right. Now, but some of the songs, as I say, they're very straightforward storytelling. Some of them are a little more impressionistic, it seems. The song about Christa McAuliffe.
Yes, which was actually a song I released on a previous album in a different arrangement.
Oh,
And it was that was kind of towards the end of putting the record together. I just really felt like that song belonged with this collection, as it were.
On the 28th of January 1986, Christa McAuliffe gazed in horror as the O-rings failed. And she died, and she died, and she died for the next agonizing 2 minutes and 45 long seconds. She called out the truth on her broken radio. I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive.
The original was written in a different key, a different tuning, a different time signature, so I sort of went back to how I'd originally written the song before changing it for the album that we did record. But yeah, you know, that's more of a poem, should we say?
Right.
You know, but I mean, the Challenger Space Shuttle disaster is so arresting as an event for everybody, and as a writer, it's kind of irresistible. And, I worked quite hard not to be voyeuristic in writing about it or sensationalist in any way, but it struck me as such a fascinating cultural and artistic moment.
Yeah, and the idea of what goes through a person's mind in the seconds where they're... spaceship is being torn apart.
Yeah. Well,
what if there was some 4-year-old Frank Turner with a ham radio getting this transmission?
Yeah, yeah. Which, of course, is a piece of fiction.
Right.
Entertainingly, the Catherine Marks, who produced the record, is a genius producer. She missed the memo about that being a piece of fiction and apparently spent like a week trying to Google who the 4-year-old kid who got the transmission was. And she eventually asked me, she's like, I can't find anything about this on Wikipedia or whatever. And I was like, it's not true. It's a flight of fancy.
So a woman produced the album.
Yes.
And the band were...
Yeah, well, I played with all women in the studio. I mean, I think the thing for me about that was that in choosing a producer to work with, it struck me that the optics, should we say, of two guys sitting in a windowless room for a month recording these songs didn't feel great to me. And also, more importantly than that, Catherine is an incredible and inventive and out there producer. She brought so much to the record just in terms of the arrangements. One of the main things she did, which I loved, is that when we were doing the vocal takes, she kept stopping me and said, "You're not telling me a story, you're just shouting at me. Like, tell me a story," you know. And like, she was like, "I need to feel engaged in the story that you're trying to tell." And I think that really brought the record together. But then, so once we'd done that, I sort of, my regular band, Sleeping Souls, who I love, you know, playing with the same band every day, it makes you very tight, which is excellent, and you have this sort of non-verbal communication. On the flip side, you get stuck into various cul-de-sacs sometimes. So I'd had the idea of working with some different players just for one record, see how that went. Once you made that decision, I was like, well, why don't we try and have an all-female band? So, I mean, it's difficult to say band because we didn't have everyone in the studio at any one time. You know, we were putting the songs together. But it was great. I mean, half the people playing the record are just old friends of mine who I knew anyway and gave them a call. But we got some wonderful people down to play on the record.
The album's called No Man's Land by Frank Turner. But now you want to go back to the preceding record.
Yeah, so if that's all right with you. I mean, I know we've talked about No Man's Land a lot, which is fantastic, but I actually wrote No Man's Land before I wrote Be More Kind, the preceding album.
Really?
But the thing was, is that I don't know if you remember 2016, but...
it's all a blur.
Yeah, everybody went nuts, both back at home and over here. And I felt driven at the time to respond in a more direct way to what was happening in the world. And I wrote an album that's called Be More Kind. And the thing is, you know, I'm not sure that songwriters are necessarily the people who should be proposing policy recommendations for how we fix the world that we've come to. But I thought a lot about what the appropriate ambition for a song was when it comes to politics, you know, because I'm not saying that songs can't be political. That's not what I mean. But like, I've seen too many punk bands announce that the following song is going to smash the government. And I think to myself, it's not, you know. But I read a poem by a writer called Clive James. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's an anglicized Australian.
Okay.
And he's a great poet and cultural critic. And he is currently terminally ill, which is very sad. And he's been writing poetry about facing the end of his days in one of his poems, Les Sons des Ténèbres, I should say. Get my French right. He wrote the lines, he says, "I should have been more kind. It is my fate to find that out, but find it out too late." And for me, if one of the people I hold in highest esteem as a writer could say that at the end of his life with a touch of regret, it's like, well, I want to make sure I don't kind of fall into that trap almost, you know. And I think that this is almost an unfashionable statement I'm going to make now. But at the end of the day, like, peaceful politics is going to be about listening and about compromise. That's where we're going to end up. And we can shout and run around the block as many times as we like in the interim. But at the end of the day, people have conflicting views of virtue and of the good life. And if we wish to live harmoniously and peacefully together, we have to listen to each other.
There's an old Quaker saying, there's no alternative to peace.
Right. In the long run, you know, we have to listen to each other sooner or later.
Yeah.
And I hope it's sooner. And even beyond that, obviously, you know, that's not to do down the fact that there is some genuinely unacceptable, violent and hate-filled rhetoric in our politics. And how do we respond to that? And I think that for me, the thing that we have to do is to hold on to our humanity like it's the most important thing. And if somebody else is devolving into a hateful caricature, don't do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, demonstrate to them what being a thoughtful human being consists of, you know. And that's my
as I like to tell people, sometimes someone has to be the adult.
Right, exactly. Do you know what I mean? And just responding by kind of dressing up in a different coloured shirt and doing the same thing is really didn't go well in Europe in the 1930s.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So, to draw the obvious parallel. But yeah, so I wrote a whole record about this, and it's not up to me which of my songs ring out in the long run, if any of them do. But if I was allowed to choose, this would be the one I would choose.
All right, the song is called Be More Kind. Here's Frank Turner.
History's been leaning on me lately. I can feel the future breathing down my neck. And all the things I thought were true when I was young and you were too turned out to be broken. And I don't know what comes next. In a world that has decided that it's going to lose its mind, be more kind, my friends, try to be more kind. They've started raising walls around the world now, like hackles raised upon a cornered cat. On the borders in our heads, between the things that can and can't be said, we've stopped talking to each other, and there's something wrong with that. So before you go out searching, don't decide what you will find. Be more kind, my friends, try to be more kind. And you should know you're not alone. Trouble comes and trouble goes. And how this ends, no one knows. Hold on tight when the wind blows. The wind blew both of us to sand and sea. Where the dry land stands is hard to say. As the current drags us by the shore, we can no longer say for sure who's drowning or if they can be saved. But when you're out there floundering like a lighthouse, I will shine. Be more kind, my friends, try to be more kind. Like a beacon reaching out to you and yours from me and mine. Be more kind, my friends, try to be more kind. In a world that has decided that it's going to lose its mind, be more kind, my friends, try to be more kind.
Frank Turner, Be More Kind, title track from the penultimate record, which I guess is the last one you actually wrote.
The most recent one I wrote, yeah.
But the new album that's out is called No Man's Land, and that album, a series of portraits of women from various parts of history. It ends with your mom.
It's a song about my mom. Not a historical figure yet.
Yeah. How did she... I know that there's a podcast for each song where you talk to experts and who would be more expert than your mom.
I was supposed to interview my mom, and then she turned the tables and she interviewed me pretty much. The song, it's a pretty heavy song in its way about the unhappier parts of my childhood and my mother's resilience through that. And I had this wonderful thing. I wrote the song and it occurred to me that I should get my mother's okay before releasing this to the world. So I sent her a scratch version of the song, and I sent it to her on Mother's Day, which I'd forgotten. And my mother replied and said, oh, it's so sweet of you to write me a song for Mother's Day. And I said, yep. That's totally what I just did. And my two sisters were outraged because they were like, you suck up. You know, they got her flowers or something. And I got her the song. And I received some irate phone calls from my sisters that particular Mother's Day.
But Mom was okay with it.
She was. I mean, she was, you know, when I got her on the podcast, my idea was because I didn't want to put my mom on the spotlight talking about things that happened to our family. And my idea was for us to just talk through the record as a whole, track by track and conceptually, which we did. And I was pleasantly surprised by how open she was when we got to that song in talking about what the song was about. That was a surprise to me that she was ready to do that. We had a difficult time growing up. I had a difficult father, let's say that, who I'm not in touch with anymore. But my mother kind of survived it and shielded her children from that. And, you know, I think she did a good job and she deserved a thank you for that. So that was that song.
Well, it's a lovely way to wrap up what is really a remarkable album.
I
I'm so glad you were able to come in and play some of it for us here today.
I'm so glad to be here, to be back here.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It has been too long, let's say. It's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Frank Turner, thank you. This is Soundcheck.
Rosemary Jane, I know I gave you a gray hair every time I messed up. Each one a silver reminder that my mistakes add up. Through every one of my unforced errors, every slip you never gave up. Sweet Rosemary Jane, it's Mothering Sunday and the headlines should say that we haven't forgotten the remarkable way that you took all that pain on your shoulders and put it away. Rosemary Jane.
That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Check us out at newsounds.org for other performances, in-studio videos, gig alerts, weekly music roundups, and more. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.